Generations have grown up with the fairy tale Beauty and the Beast. It's been retold many times and was the basis of a 1946 movie by Jean Cocteau. It's also the inspiration for a new TV series that begins this Friday night. Last year, a CBS programming executive saw the Cocteau film and began to explore the possibilities of a modern-day version. My guest, Ron Coslow, was hired to create the show's pilot, and he became the supervising producer for the series Beauty and the Beast. He describes it this way.
It's a love story. It's a story of, it's actually a contemporary fable. It's a story of Catherine, who was a very wealthy socialite, Upper East Side attorney. And she's attacked and slashed and left for dead in Central Park. And this is really the way the story begins. She is found by Vincent, who is this man-beast who lives in the tunnels in a subterranean world below Manhattan. And it's about their the bond between the two of them, their empathic relationship.
Vincent is half-man and half-beast. Actually, he looks like half man and half lion.
Yeah, there is a feline quality to him. How he got that way, we are intentionally leaving mysterious for the time being. But he is not a deformed person. He is really another species. If you took a sample of his blood and checked the DNA code, it would be unlike anything you've ever seen.
The Beauty and the Beast in the show have a deep love for each other and a deep understanding, but I assume that the love is not going to ever be consummated sexually, because after all, he's a beast. Is this going to be the ultimate safe sex kind of show?
Well, people have asked me that. I really, you know, it certainly wasn't intended to be that. I mean, one of the interesting things about their relationship is that because, for the moment anyway, that kind of consummation isn't possible, it allows us to explore a different kind of communion between the two of them. And maybe it harkens back to the times when lovers made love with words and ideas and thoughts and emotions rather than jumping into bed.
This beast lives under the streets of Manhattan in a series of tunnels, and these tunnels connect to the underground subways of Manhattan. And the beast lives there, his adopted father lives there, and you get a sense that there's this whole alternative culture that's living under the streets of New York.
Yes.
How did you come up with this idea of a culture living underground in Manhattan?
I had read there were a couple of newspaper articles in the late 70s about people living in the steam tunnels below the Waldorf Astoria, and they were homeless people, but it was winter, and they had found a place where there was warmth, and they were actually foraging their food from the restaurant at the Waldorf and eating quite well, and while these were by no means great circumstances, it really intrigued me, the idea that there was this whole network of New York. I think one of the problems of New York, of course, is the geography, is the fact that everybody is jammed up together. And just below the city streets is a world that there are at least 300 miles of tunnels below New York. Many of them are uncharted. Many of the maps have been lost. And it really piqued my imagination.
Do you know what those tunnels were created for?
Yes, they were for different purposes. They really began digging tunnels about 150 years ago for water conduits. At a certain point in the early part of this century, many of the buildings were heated by steam, so there were steam tunnels. There were electrical circuit tunnels. Many of the phone lines in New York are run through tunnels. So there's a whole archaeology of tunnels and tunnel systems below the city streets in Manhattan.
What did it feel like to go deep underground and walk around these tunnels?
Well, it's interesting. We were there in early spring, so it was still cold. And these particular tunnels, which were near the reservoir, were a little chilly. But there's an incredible solitude and a wonderful stillness down there, you know, as you you descend. You lose all that buzz and noise from the streets above, and you're standing there. It's a very odd feeling. You can be standing there. You're really standing in the center of Manhattan, not far from the 86th Street Traverse, and there's utter stillness, and it's quite wonderful, actually. It's quite, very magical.
I think that this part of Beauty and the Beast is such a New York fantasy, this whole idea of an underground culture. You're walking on the streets, and there's people living underneath you, yet you've lived in Los Angeles since you were 10, and I'm interested in how you've really captured such a New York fantasy.
My family lives in New York and has lived there for quite a while, and I spend a lot of time in New York and am constantly amazed and intrigued by it. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this show is because I really wanted to do something. I truly believe that New York is a magical place, and I wanted to do a story that dealt with some of that. It really seems to me to be the contemporary primeval forest. It's just everywhere you look. You walk down 57th Street on a normal evening, and every second step you take knocks you out. You see something that just absolutely stuns you.
You know, a lot of people don't know about these tunnels, and I think through your TV show, they're going to find out about it. Do you think that a lot more people are going to be trying to get underground now, and especially people who are homeless who have no place to live and who would be finding shelter there?
I think there already are a lot of homeless people who are living in some of these tunnels. Many of the tunnels that we're talking about are almost impossible to get into.
How did you get down into them?
With the help of the city of New York and the Parks Department.
And do they not want you to tell publicly where the entrances are and how to do it?
We really can't tell how to get down there, and even if we did tell exactly where the entrance was, it would be impossible for anyone to really get down there at this point.
Did you reread the fairy tale of Beauty and the Beast or see the Cocteau movie before writing the pilot?
Yes. I was familiar with the fairy tale, and I had seen the Cocteau film and was always impressed by it and affected by it. And it really seemed to take the fairy tale a quantum leap. It into surreal directions, into erotic directions, and I was influenced by that.
When you first read the fairy tale or had it read to you as a child, who did you identify with, the beauty or the beast?
That's a good question. I think probably both. I mean, that's the interesting thing about the myth, is that it does appeal to both sides, and it is about in certain ways acceptance of both sides of yourself. I believe it's part of a cycle of those transformation myths, which are meant to teach children, to look beyond the surfaces and to search for the inner good and inner beauty. But I think that applies not only in dealing with another, but also in confronting yourself. So, I think that perhaps a myth is designed to appeal for you to identify with both.
Where are you going to watch the premiere episode?
Well, we're going to be working. We'll be shooting. We'll be shooting, in Vincent's chamber that night, and I think we'll finish early and set up a TV and watch the pilot and have some champagne and feel very happy and lucky.
And then get back to work.
And then get back to work.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ron Coslow is the creator and supervising producer for the new TV series Beauty and the Beast. It begins Friday night on CBS.